Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Catherine Kratzer Laborde, whose new book is Flannery O'Connor's Manhattan. It is a great pleasure to welcome Catherine Kratzer Laborde to The Reading Life. Catherine is a professor of English at Xavier University of Louisiana and the author of Do Not Open, The Discarded Refrigerators of Post-Katrina New Orleans, and The Story Behind the Painting, Frederick J. Brown's The Assumption of Mary at Xavier University. Today, we're talking about her new book, Flannery O'Connor's Manhattan. Catherine, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
The backstory behind this book is so fascinating. Like many scholars, you thought you were going to write a particular book, mm-hmm. and you ended up writing something completely different. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, you said like many scholars, I really think of myself more as a writer because that's who I am. My background is I have an MFA from University of New Orleans, yay, in fiction, and I have a freelance journalism background. So I always approach things as a writer. I had this idea, I guess around 2015, 2016, to write a book of creative nonfiction, which is my preferred literary form, of creative nonfiction that has to do with Flannery O'Connor and setting. I'll just leave it with that. Personal settings that she knew as an adult. And in doing that, I knew that at Emory, they had just recently acquired all these wonderful, wonderful resources that had not been available before. I'm talking about letters and all kinds of things.
Cartoons.
Yes, so much.
Prayer journal.
Yes, absolutely. And so much of these things many people know now. Because of this, there's recently been a book, which was not available at the time, it wasn't out yet, a book of the letters Flannery wrote to her mother while Flannery was in graduate school in Iowa. Well, those were not out. Those were not published. I went there to read those. And for those of you in the audience who've never been to an archive or done that, you have to set up stuff way ahead of time. You have to tell them exactly what it is. It's like you're given this wonderful menu and you're picking what it is you're going to eat way ahead of time. And if you're smart, you try to pick more because you don't want to run out. So one of the things I saw in there, actually the very first box, the very first folder, all that sort of thing was, address books. And I thought, that sounds interesting. And I just checked it off, not really thinking about it. And at one point in reading all these letters, I got so tired of reading about how Flannery O'Connor was going to eat chicken a la king, how she was begging her mother to make homemade mayonnaise. Yes, there is a difference. It's so funny. It's so funny. Mama, can you hem my skirt here? I'm sending it to you. Mm-hmm. I got tired of that after a while. And I thought, I cannot read this anymore. So I said, let me look at those address books. and first of all, even though I'd been seeing her handwriting in these handwritten letters, to see address books with all the scratch outs and all the arrows, and then, Catherine Ann Porter. These people that you know, Patricia Highsmith. And they're just in there like anybody else, including I think there was a Tupperware lady in there as well, and one of them. Start looking at those, had a personal connection because of something mentioned about the Xavier University studies, which, I talk about in the book. And I thought, I'm going to New York soon to do this again, exploring the sense of place where O'Connor had been. I said, let me just take a look at these addresses and stuff and see what's there before I go. I mean, I knew I was going to go to the two places she had lived in for a bit in 1949, but I said, let me see what else is here. So start writing stuff down. And when I got home, having dinner at my then boyfriend's house. And I said, I've got this great idea for an essay, like the kind of essay you'd put in The New Yorker, really, really long. And it's about, the places, these are the places in her address book. So these are the places she knew, mm-hmm. or people she knew. And I just sort of handed him a list that I just started. And he just got this look on his face. And he's like, this is not an essay. This is a book. I'm like, oh, no, it's not. Well, when I got off the plane to New York, I had time to go through all the addresses, and I was trying to put them in some kind of order, and I realized there was so much to them. And I was like, you're right. My essay is actually a book. And when it became a book, it actually grew some legs, and it took off in some different directions that if I kept it just as an essay, that it wouldn't have happened.
So talk about constructing that walking tour, which is irresistible.
Yes. Well, there's an appendix in the back of the book, which you might have seen, which if you are interested in trying to link some of these places I talk about, and maybe I should talk about the structure of the book too, mm-hmm. so this makes more sense. Yeah. But if you want to do that, if you know New York well enough, or you're going there and you're thinking, what could I possibly see that's together? I sort of, and it's based only on, which I know this could be controversial at that, the post office idea of what's a neighborhood, mm-hmm. what parts of town and all. And I know people argue about that, but basically based on zip codes. And so if you're interested, you can, I say whose place it is, and then you look up the who's who of that, and then right. you can put something together that way. I'm not a New Yorker, and I just thought I'm not going to even try to do anything more beyond that.
It's Manhattan.
It is Manhattan, absolutely. And to that point, there was in her address books, there were some Bronx and Brooklyn addresses that I did not include because it's not Manhattan.
Well, talk about her handwriting and what it's like when you're going through all these papers.
Think about when you're in a new relationship with somebody and the first time you see a note or a card and they've written to mm-hmm. you, you've crossed a line. It's intimate. Mm-hmm. It really, really is.
Especially now.
And so in the first time I actually saw her handwriting, I want to say was actually in New Orleans. It was at the Words of Music, and Father Patrick Samway was in town to lead a panel that I got to be on. And it was about the year of Flannery O'Connor that was coming up for whatever reason. I was on there. Dr. Holditch was on there. Mm-hmm. A few other people were on there. And Father Patrick, as a treat, brought letters, copies of letters that he had that were from Flannery to Bob Giroux, her editor, whom he knew very well. And he was working on a book, which is out now. It's really, really good. A book about Giroux's and O'Connor's relationship. Mm-hmm. So after the talk was over, I stepped down. I went to the table and I'm like, there it is. And it's a very intimate moment, I would say so. In seeing her handwriting over and over again, it's like anyone else's handwriting. As in her typical handwriting is rather roundish.
And bold.
Absolutely bold. But there are times you can kind of tell, well, this doesn't quite look like that. But, we don't always, we think we always write the same way, and we don't. I know certain pens I will not write as well as I just don't have the control. Certain pens, or if I'm tired, or if I'm in a hurry, or if I'm writing on something and it's at an angle and that kind of thing. So there are times it's kind of like, wow, her handwriting looks different here. But you can always see, and you would notice this in your own address books if you ever go through those or someone else's, oh, this is when I was starting out and everything's in the same color ink and nicely done. And then comes the reality, which represents life itself. People move, people die, people take themselves out of our lives, or we push them out ourselves. And it's really interesting to see that actually knowing the history, the story of some of these people that were in there was how I was able to more or less date the five books.
They're also one of the few books that ordinary people have that they edit.
That's true.
Over time.
If they do it at all. I mean, nowadays, everyone just puts stuff on their phones.
Oh, I know.
We've lost a lot. And that goes for letters as well. As I was going through this and looking at all this, I was just bemoaning the fact that I am learning so much about O'Connor because this exists. First of all, she did this. That's what people did. Secondly, people didn't trash it. People didn't think. thankfully did not trash it, because who would think, what could we get from these? I got so much, including what was written about in the preface, which I don't know if you had a chance to read the preface, but, you know, and that was just based on, you know, the story of that. It was like some random note that she put in one of her address books about an event she was invited to. And that led to my making a realization about something that happened or didn't happen in the very early days of her career.
So these trips to New York often were particularly important times in her life. So talk a little bit about that.
First of all, I just want to talk a little bit about the organization of the book, if I may.
Oh, sure. Let's go back to that.
Because it's a weird little organization. The book's divided into, if you're not counting the introduction and the preface, there are those sayings, and then you start the book. The first part of the book is about what you've just asked about, and these are the times she went to New York. Mm-hmm. She wasn't there a lot, so it's really worth, you can kind of go, oh, this comes from this series, this comes from this series. The second half of the book are the people and places that are mentioned in her five personal address books. And so what I do, that were in Manhattan. Some of these people are part of the writing profession. They're editors, they're agents, they're secretaries to the, you know, publishing house, whatever it is. Some of these people are people that she just knew. Some of these people might be writers, that sort of thing. And then the places, you know, certain places, and by that could be the publishing house itself or just whatever, some sort of business that she felt the need to write down the address.
Or even churches.
Yeah, exactly. So all that sort of thing is there. So that's the second half of the book. The first half of the book, I did a lot of reading of unpublished letters as well as published. Mm-hmm. I have found, and I found this frustrating because I wanted to know more about her time in New York. In biographies, you know, you might get a page. Yeah, she was in New York. Or a mention. Oh, well, she graduated from Iowa. She went to Yaddo, you know, the artist colony, which was important. And then she went to New York for a bit. And then she went to Connecticut and was with the Fitzgeralds and blah, blah, blah. I'm going, New York, how can you put just a mention? I mean, it's not like any other place. It's New York, particularly to a person who's at the very early stages of her writing career, which New York, of course, was just the mecca of at that point.
Publishing mecca, yes.
Exactly. So in this book, I discuss, you know, again, the different times. We start off with something I've never actually really read about. I don't even know if I've read mention of. I could be wrong. But it was her first trip to New York. It was in 1943. Her father had died maybe about 2 years before. And she and her mother were living in Milledgeville, not in Andalusia, you know, the farm that people associate with her, but in the Klein family mansion, which is on Green Street. Her grandfather or great-grandfather had been, I want to say, the mayor of Milledgeville or something like that. So, you know, they did okay. They had a mansion. They lived there. Mom, Regina, had to go stay with family. I believe it was Cousin Katie for a couple of months or two. This is the summer. And this part's not in writing. This part you kind of have to gather just from what you read, kind of put it together. Obviously, it was like, okay, Mary Flannery, as her mother would call her, Mary Flannery, I want you to go stay with your cousins while I'm gone. Your cousins are in Massachusetts. And she knew her cousins very well. They would come to Milledgeville every summer. So she knew these girls. So somehow or another, it was arranged that Mary Flannery would go all the way up there, travel. And she's like, I think maybe 18 at this point, something like that. But she goes with a family friend, Lydia Bancroft, who was a teacher at what's at that point a women's college in Milledgeville. Now it's Georgia College, but at the time it was like Georgia Women's College or something like that. So she was a teacher. She would occasionally actually live in the mansion. They would take in some teachers as boarders. So one can imagine the, you know, conversation, oh, I'll go with her and she needs to see New York. My sister's in New Jersey. We can stay there. It can be educational. And, you know, the word educational, which was a word we would use to get our parents to let us do things. Mm-hmm. I have the feeling that Cousin Katie, who was very, very well off, probably helped pay for this trip. So Flannery went to, on her way to Massachusetts, stopped off in New York, you know, staying in New Jersey, and saw New York with older friends. Lydia, I want to say it's, I've got it in the book, I think she was in her 60s. Lydia's sister, Helen, there was the mother. She didn't go walking around with them in New York, but, you know, that's where they stayed, was with her mm-hmm. sister, Grace. And then there was this artist, this painter by the name of Margaret Sutton, who had taught in Milledgeville at the college. And so she's there as well. And what's interesting is that she sees all kinds of things that, you know, one would see in New York, St. Patrick's Cathedral, the museum, especially the Natural Museum of Art. You know, she loved the ducks there. But they also made sure that she saw that New Yorkers, or I should say, people who live outside the South don't live the same way Southerners do. They sit next to each other in buses. They sit next to each other on benches. They use the same bathrooms. They sit together in restaurants. And she was seeing that for the first time.
At an impressionable age.
At a very impressionable age. And what's interesting is that while she's just also, she's going to a Chinese restaurant for the first time.
I know. I love that.
you know, it's and we were like, now, big deal, Chinese restaurant. But back then, people, I mean, it wasn't as common. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, there were a lot of people who called, you know, what was it? I can't think of soy sauce. They called it bug juice.
Oh,
yeah, that's what they called it. It was like, I learned that writing the book. Like, that was an old name for it. What? Probably by people who had this thing, oh, it's Chinese, it's foreign, and that kind of thing. So she was experiencing a whole lot then. And the effect is that I think 2 or 3 years later, when she's in graduate school, and there is a Black student in the writing program with her, and it turns out they're on a bus together at some point going back home for the holidays, and she mentions this obviously in a letter to her mother. And her mother, we don't get to see those letters. We really don't get to see any of Regina's letters unless they accidentally got passed over because her handwriting's similar. So I did see a couple of them. It's like, oh, wait a minute. But you don't know till you get, it's like, wait a minute. This is not Flannery, you know? She fusses at her mother and basically says, no, mind your own business. I can sit next to her. Plus, there was no other place to sit. What do you want me to do? Stay off the bus? I mean, as a mother, get a handle on things. Had she not been exposed already in New York, because there is one letter, she describes going into an automat, which for those of us like me who have never seen these places, you go in, you press a button, and the piece of pie comes out or the sandwich comes out. And it was like a big deal in New York at the time.
I know. I'm sorry I missed the automat.
I understand they're coming back.
I hope.
I would love that. But anyway, she describes being in an automat in that first trip to New York, and she sees this Black young woman walking with her food, and she's heading toward a table with three white people sitting there. And she's like, and she sat down. And then she's like, but they didn't seem to mind, which this is making an impression. And you got to think maybe that opened the door for later on. She would not be, you know, she wouldn't notice it as much, would not be bothered, would not feel uncomfortable with, maybe. I don't know exactly because I'm not her and I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But it opened a door. So we have the very first New York trip. We have after that, basically 1948 to like 1950 or so. In 48, she was at Yaddo. And Yaddo, I think, is like a 3-hour train ride away, 2 hours, something like that. But she would occasionally, because she had business with a new agent, and she was trying to get some sort of deal done with a book publisher, she would on occasion come into New York. She had plans to possibly move to New York after her Yaddo stay was over, but her Yaddo stay got ended a lot more quickly than she had anticipated because there was a big flare-up about communism, and I'll just leave it at that. But people end up, if not many people were there at the time because it was the winter. She was there with Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Hardwick, and I think it was Ed Maisel, and then O'Connor, and because there was this huge controversy, they had to leave soon. And so they just...
Quickly.
Absolutely. And so it turns out Robert Lowell said, okay, everybody, let's go to New York. I want to talk to the Fitzgeralds about this. So and Flannery's like, okay, we're going, fine. She goes, she stays with Elizabeth Hardwick for a few days, finds a place to stay at Tatum House, which is like a YWCA sort of place at the time. One of the women's hotels, which was really interesting. I didn't really know about them. I ended up learning a lot. So she stayed there for about 2 weeks. She was very concerned about money. I really don't have money. I don't really have this, that, and the other. If I don't have an appointment with so-and-so, I can't really, stay here because I don't really, it's not worth it for me financially. She was very concerned about that. She was at Tatum. But before she left New York, before she left Tatum, before she went back home for a spell, only to come back.
So what do you feel like going through all these papers was the little treasure that was there waiting for you, just for you?
I think, first of all, putting together that, and this was written about in the preface, this wedding that she was invited to, this man that she had feelings for, and was getting married anyway to someone else, and she was invited to the wedding, and she didn't go. And we know from other things that were written, she didn't go because who wants to see someone you're crazy right. about marry somebody else? You don't. But what did she do that day? She wrote her first letter to the woman who had become her agent. And, there is a cartoon. You were talking about the cartoons. Mm-hmm. There was a cartoon that O'Connor had done for the college, for the college newspaper that she would do cartoons for. And the cartoon is this young woman who's at a dance, and she's just sitting there by herself, and all the other people are dancing with boys. And she says, oh, well, I can always be a PhD. And I felt that this is my fine. Oh, well. And not that she wouldn't have written anyway, not that she would never have been published anyway, but she did it then. And when I all of a sudden had, first of all, when I figured out this is that wedding we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then when I figured all of a sudden, I was like, June, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. And I went to Habit of Being and saw the date. So that I felt was waiting for me. There were some other things, some connections that I just kept struggling over. Who is this person? Who is this person? What is this? And when I made those connections, I was jumping up and down.
That's magic.
And doing actually victory laps around my house. Just
the magic of the archives.
The magic of it. Yes, absolutely.
Well, everybody will think of Flannery O'Connor in a new light.
I hope so.
This is so great.
I hope so.
We've been talking with Catherine Crotzer Laborde, whose new book is Flannery O'Connor's Manhattan. You can meet her Tuesday, October 1st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The exhibit, A Distinguished Trajectory, Reshaping Histories at the Latin American Library, celebrates 100 years of Latin American studies at Tulane and tells the story of Tulane's long engagement with Latin America through the library's many treasures. There's an opening reception Friday, September 27th from 5 to 7 at the library, which is located on the fourth floor of Howard Tilton Library at Tulane. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library bring their book sale to the Arts Market at Marsalis Harmony Park, Saturday, September 28th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Guy Trebé discusses Do Something, coming of age amid the glitter and doom of 70s New York. He'll be in conversation with Diane Sustendahl, Saturday, September 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. One Book, One New Orleans and the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans celebrate Banned Books Week with Unsilenced Voices, Saturday, September 28th at 3 at East New Orleans Regional Library on Reed Boulevard. There will be open mic readings from a diverse selection of banned books such as The Bluest Eye, Harry Potter, The Handmaid's Tale, and The Catcher in the Rye. If you'd like to participate in the open mic, please choose age-appropriate excerpts for a family-friendly event. Registration is free at Eventbrite, but space is limited. The Faulkner Society Fall Festival, Faulkner for All, starts Friday, September 27th and features Lawrence William Coates, best-selling author Thomas Mallon, Elizabeth Williams, founder of the National Food and Beverage Museum, Zella Palmer, special guest of honor Marcel Bienvenu, and poet-publisher Bill Lavender. For full information, check out faulknersociety.org. And here are the winners of the William Wisdom Writing Competition who will receive their awards this weekend at the festival. It's an international group. For novel, Indiana Queer by Michael Sadowski of Rhinebeck, New York. Nonfiction book is a tie for the winner. Slow Ride by Randy Denman of Monroe and New Orleans, and In Search of the Thickest Towel by Liza Porter of Tucson. Novella, No Such Agency by Michael Ditchfield of Martha's Vineyard. Short Story, Slot Machine by Andrew Plattner of Atlanta. Essay, Warehousing the Elderly by Gail Wallstein of Denver. Book in Progress, Rescue by Minrose Gwynn of Albuquerque. Poetry Collection, Every Marred Thing, A Time in America by Patrick T. Reardon of Chicago. Individual poem, My Mother Stands on Her Feet for the Last Time, by Janet Ford of Taylorsville, North Carolina. And high school short story, Edelweiss, by Yang Si He of Guangzhou, China. Yuri Herrera discusses and signs Season of the Swamp, Tuesday, October 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Catherine Kratzer-Laborde discusses and signs Flannery O'Connor's Manhattan, Tuesday, October 1st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And Sandra Smith discusses and signs the Enneagram Map to Your Deeper Self, Wednesday, October 2nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.